In today's episode, we talk about the interplay between written and visual art, the methods used to find meaning and purpose in your life. We also talk about C.S. Lewis. There's a lot about C.S. Lewis. Hopefully you like him, and if you're not familiar with his works, you certainly will be after this episode. And finally, we talked about returning to small communities and how social media has sort of corrupted healthy competition. So without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. Today on this episode of We'll Work for Purpose, I'm joined by author and illustrator J.K. Rieke. He owns a company called Weekend Panda and just published a book on a response to an essay written by Bertrand Russell titled Why I'm Not a Christian. J.K., how are you doing?
Pretty good. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it.
Awesome. Glad to have you on. So how exactly did you get started writing, illustrating, you know, kind of in the art world and all that? How did you get started in that kind of line of work?
Well, it probably goes back to my childhood. I think most artists get started way back when. One of those things where you find attention via doing funny little drawings or writing goofy stories. One of my first pieces of writing that I shared with others was interestingly in middle school, and my now wife edited it because I knew her way back then. So been going a long time. Weekend Panda, which we now run, is a joint effort by her and I. I do the art end and she does the software engineering and all the technical stuff. So it's kind of been a long journey in that regard from the very beginning. But I think that early on, it really was an attention-based thing where I discovered that I could draw halfway decently so that people enjoyed it. And then I could write some interesting things and people also enjoyed that. So I just kept doing it. And that kind of just snowballed into, if you could call it a career.
Did you ever hold like a traditional job or were you always a freelancer kind of working for yourself?
I don't know how traditional they are because my jobs have included working in a bowling alley, an employee at Funko Land, which was before Electronic Boutique, which was before GameStop. I had a brief stint recently as a elementary school cafeteria worker, and then I also taught kids after school animation. So I don't know that any job I've ever had has been traditional, but I have had some normal jobs that paid regular salaries and did not particularly enjoy the regularity of that. So that's why I mostly do freelance now.
Mm, awesome. So like whenever you were growing up as a kid, was there a particular piece that you drew that all of a sudden people were like, whoa, JK has a talent for this. Like we really, you know, he's a really good artist, you know, like, and did your parents ever like put you in art school or anything like that? Or was it kind of just something you developed on your own? And like all of a sudden people started to get, take attention up to you, or, you know, how did that kind of happen?
Yeah. So I definitely think that there was some art schooling in there. I don't know at that age how much I got out of it because, you know, there's a certain age where you're not paying any attention to anybody else. But I did take some summer classes at a local museum, which was really cool because after the class was over, it was like however many weeks, they actually hung your art in the museum. It was a hallway that led to the classroom, but you thought it was the museum and it was super cool. And so stuff like that would just enthrall me. My best friend in middle school, high school, we entered an art competition together and I was such a slacker, but I basically did my piece in, I don't know, an hour maybe, just, and it was very creative. It was decently done, but it wasn't great. I mean, it was fine for my age. He spent like days working on this gorgeous, I think it was a dragon, and I'm pretty sure he got first place. I don't think I got first place, but either way, we were both like one and two. And he was so mad because he worked so hard on his and I just threw mine together. But it was things like that, I think, that really drove me. It was, oh, I have an affinity to this thing. So let me keep doing it because I don't have an affinity to a lot of other things. So I think that was partially what drove it. As far as specific projects, in middle school, I created a comic series called Fred the Monkey, which was a parody of Curious George. And instead of just being a straight up parody of Curious George, Fred the Monkey was this horrifically violent and kind of nihilistic comic about, because I mean, you're in middle school, so whatever, about this monkey who would just get dismembered and, by being curious and things like that. It was deeply terrible, but everybody loved it, so I kept doing it. And then one of my first few forays into animation was a website called fredthemonkey.com, which still exists. I don't really update it anymore, but Flash became a thing around the time I was in college. And so I jumped on board that and started creating. It was kind of, I don't know if you're familiar with homestarrunner.com.
No, never heard of it. No.
Okay. It was pretty popular back at that time. And so I saw somebody else do this thing that I had always wanted to do, which was animation. And I kind of jumped on that and created a version of it called fredthemonkey.com. So Fred the Monkey, I think, was the thing that really kicked it all off, because that was the first ongoing series I made. That was the first thing that was like cohesive, really. So I think that was probably the launching point.
Is Fred the Monkey something that you would ever go back to? Like, is that something you could ever see yourself working on again?
Yeah, I think so. I probably would still be doing Fred the Monkey, if not for two things. First, when you animate a whole cartoon yourself, it really burns you out. Mm-hmm. So it was just kind of unsustainable, because I tried to do it every week and it just was not a reasonable thing. I did it for years though. The second thing is that I got really fed up with Flash as a program, mm-hmm. and Adobe as a company. So I moved over to Toon Boom Animate at the time. It was called Toon Boom Harmony now, or maybe just Harmony. I never quite made that jump successfully. The just technical end, it kind of broke me. So if I dedicated myself to relearning that program, I think I definitely would go back to doing some Fred things. It was a joy to do, because you got to make just goofy characters and do voices, and it was fun. So I would go back, and I keep telling people who bother me about it, one day I'll do some more. I would love to do like a wrap up season and then call it a day, but we'll see. We'll see what happens.
So you were creating comics, and that kind of like ties in the writing aspect of what you like to do. Do you think that do you think your writing and your artistry, they co-developed and like they were kind of fed off each other? Or do you think like eventually like you grew to a point where like just the writing or the passion for writing just kind of overtook the art in a way?
I think they were kind of hand in hand. I had always said that I, during high school, I said, I either want to be a writer / journalist, or I want to be an artist / animator. Those were my, or a psychologist, interestingly, which I think ties also into them, because you can't really do writing or art without some heavy duty knowledge of human beings. It was either one of those two things. And I think that they worked in tandem. I think because I could get instant gratification, reaction, attention for the art, I continued that harder at that time. And then later, as things progressed, I realized I don't care how much attention I get. I love the writing more, so I'm going to do that harder, even though maybe only my mother ever reads it. But she really enjoys it, so thanks, Mom.
Yeah, I kind of have that problem, because I like to write, and actually just received maybe the most accurate criticism on one of my posts. It was kind of, admittedly, it was long for a blog post. It was like 3,500 words of just, you know, writing. And the guy said, you write very well, but I wish you could say it in fewer words, you know, and like, and so I too have that kind of like, I've never had a proclivity for art, so I've never been able to like draw something and like people be like, oh, that's really cool, you know, like I like that. So like I've never had that temptation in that sense to, I can imagine that it's a temptation anyways, that to produce art, because, you know, you can see it on Instagram. It takes like 2 seconds to consume that thing that you worked on. And you know that everyone who sees it will consume it because it's consumed by their very seeing it, you know?
Yeah.
Whereas like with writing, like I may write, you could write, I mean, you just finished a book. It's like 85 pages or something. And like, not everyone's going to read all 85 pages or understand it in the way that you want them to understand it and things like that. Do you like, is that ever hard to choose? Like, I guess you have made your choice. You do prefer writing to art, no matter who reads it. And I think that that's amazing. You know, not everyone gets that insight, but like, do you think that, do you find it difficult sometimes? Like, do you find yourself wishing that you're like, I'm just going to give up this writing thing? Like, does it ever frustrate you even though you're passionate about it?
As I get older, less and less, but I think that that's always going to be there, that sense. I was talking to my wife yesterday about it. I was recently reading a writing book. It was called The Art of War for Writers. That's pretty good. But in it, there's a part that one of the authors that he talks to writes this long part about how writing is an emotional roller coaster. So you get an idea and you're super excited about it. And like, you're so high and you run and you start writing and it's great and you're happy. And then you maybe, even if you finish, you read what you wrote and you're like, wow, this is garbage. Like, I hate this. I'm the worst writer in the world. And then you're like, well, I'm gonna edit it anyway. So you do. And then when you edit it, you're like, oh, this isn't so bad. And in this case, the person was published. So they said, they send it off to an editor and they're so excited. And then they don't hear back for a few days. And they're like, oh, they hated it. Like, I'm doomed. This is it. This is the end of my career. And then they get an email and it says, I loved it. It was great. And they're like, yes, this is the best thing ever. And then they get the copy edit back and they see all the red marks and they're like, I'm doomed. And so that is kind of how it goes for a writer. And I think that that speaks to what you're saying with, you know, if you allow those low moments to control your pursuit of the high moments again, then you're doomed. You will quit. There is no way that anybody is going to sit there in that hole and say, I'll keep doing this anyway, because it's just a nightmare. It's depressing. But if you push past that, which I think at this stage of my life, I'm starting to understand how to push past that. That's when you get to the places where you're like, oh, I just published a 22,000 word book and look how great it was. And look, I'm going to put it online and now I'm feeling high. And uh-oh, I didn't get a response on Twitter in 30 seconds. I feel like crap now. Mm-hmm. So follow-up question for you. You mentioned the whole using a lot of words. Mm-hmm. And that is something near and dear to my heart because I'm a fan of C.S. Lewis. Mm-hmm. And interestingly, I'm now a fan of Bertrand Russell's writing, maybe not his ideology, but his writing. Mm-hmm. They're both very good at saying a lot in not a lot of words. So do you find that there's something that helps you with that? Like, do you go back and try and rip out words? A little anecdote while you're thinking of that. I started editing my Bertrand Russell book and I removed a whole section. It was like 2 pages long, whole section. I went through, I started deleting stuff. I was like, there's frivolous words here. Take them out, blah, blah, blah. When I was done, I had somehow added 1,000 words to the thing. Mm. And I just sat there staring at that number and thinking, surely this is wrong. Mm. But for some reason, speaking briefly is not my cup of tea either.
Yeah, I think, no, I mean, it's definitely not mine because I'm a lover of words in general. Like, I like the way they sound. I like looking at them. I like knowing them. I like the meaning behind them. Like, I'd be able to say a big word that has like this multivariant like definition. Like, I just like that, you know, like I just like the way it looks on paper. Like, it's an aesthetic thing for me to a certain degree, but it's also my detriment when I'm writing. And I think that it's like C.S. Lewis in particular, because I've read every book he's had like more than one time. He's by far my favorite author. And he was at the beginning of my conversion to Christianity. And he uses a lot of images, and images are like textual imagery, you know, like a metaphor, an analogy, parable, like all these figurative languages. Like, and so like whenever you tell, for instance, there's this one essay on transposition where he talks about bringing something from a higher system to a lower system, and he's using language, but he also uses the image of a woman in prison. He asks us to imagine that there's a woman in prison, and in this cell, she bears and rears a child. And there's only a window above them, but it's so high they can't see out of it, so only light comes in. And in this prison, she's been afforded some charcoal and paper. And so she starts to teach her son about the outside world, and she draws mountains, and she draws a, you know, sun, sunset, you know, sunrise, forests, rivers, etc. Like, she draws all these landscapes. And all of a sudden, after, you know, several like years of this tutoring, like teaching him about the outside world, he asks a question which, you know, gives the mother pause. He essentially said something about like, well, how do you navigate the straight lines? And she goes, straight lines? What do you mean? There are no straight lines out there. And he goes, what? No straight lines there? He had mistaken the image for the real thing. He had thought the outside world was the charcoal image, you know? But like, that story, I think, only takes two paragraphs, but it has such immense meaning in it. It's like, it's one of those things. It's like, I think about it even now, and I haven't read that, and I don't even, it's probably been a year since I read that, you know? And like, I think about that type of thing all the time, you know? And so in my personal life, like whenever I speak to people, I do use metaphors and images and analogies and, you know, all these, like, I use figurative language a lot, especially because people really like, you know, to be like, oh yeah, I understand that. And so like, and I think also like in C.S. Lewis's case, he wanted to be every man. He wanted to be like an everyday Joe, you know, like that was his kind of, he had this high intellect, but he didn't want it. He wanted to be, you know, Mr. Dock Worker, Mr. Steel Worker, you know, like Mr. Guy on the street, you know? And so like that gave him the ability to understand and communicate in ways that like anybody could get behind, you know? And so like for instance, if I'm speaking to somebody, who, like, if I know their profession, you know, if I know they're an engineer, or if I know they're a hairdresser or an artist, like, I try to speak in those terms. So like, I find myself trying to be acquainted with like every field of profession in that sense, you know, or find some point of contact, like whether it may not be the profession, but it may be soccer or hockey, or it may be, you know, maybe something. And I just try and like, sort of distill the idea down into that. But as you noticed, even like, I just talked for an inordinate amount of time. I could have given a shorter answer to this question, you know? And so like, that's also the problem. But like, and so in my writing, though it hurts me, I do take a razor blade and I'll just be like, I really like this paragraph, but I bet no one else will read it or find it interesting. And I just remove it and I put it somewhere else for my personal pleasure. Like, I save the two different copies, like the my copy and the everyone else copy. And I frequently can get down in size, but then also like what inevitably happens is like, I kind of like begin chapter two, because like, I may be like, we'll write the whole thing and be like, well, it needs some addition here. And then I write a whole point and then I cut it and like, oh, that should actually go at the bottom. And then all of a sudden it's like a whole separate, becomes a mess basically. But so to your answer, I don't really have a direct process of reducing the total word count. Although end up doing is just essentially writing and cutting off half the post and just sharing half the post or half the thing. And like the parts that like, the bloviating, the extended parts end up becoming either a second post or something I never share, basically. So like on my end, it always looks as long as it's ever been, but on the public end, it becomes much shorter.
That is fair. I totally understand. Yeah. It's in January, I started a blog called 500 Word Theology, which I didn't realize just how much was going to push me to grow as a writer, because I try to keep every post 500 words and it is impossible to say anything in 500 words. So I have some that are multi-part, but it's the same as you. I have in my own saved draft folder ones that are 1500 words, and 1,000 of them just don't get put up online because I'm trying to commit myself to brevity for the sake of clarity instead of just rambling. And I mean, but I would say this, I don't know if you've read David Bentley Hart at all.
He's been recommended to me several times. I have not read
him. I can't, necessarily recommend him. Like, part of me wants to recommend him. The other part says you're going to instantly get a headache and it will be a miserable nightmare. I have a lot of respect for what he does and his intellect, but he does not cut words. I have never read a book that thickly like written. It was so hard. So I you know, as much as I say that in terms of don't do that, there is a place for that. So I don't think we necessarily have to all be C.S. Lewis, even if I and you probably really want to be. There's probably a place for a little more long form. And it's tricky because in our world today, as you said earlier, people just want that 4 second, I just absorbed everything and I'm moving on now. So in a sense, we have to be comfortable just putting it out there and hoping that it finds that right person or whatever it is. Because they're there. I'm sure there were days that C.S. Lewis thought, is anybody going to care about this writing? And here we are gushing over him, 50 years, 100 years later, almost.
I sometimes wonder about the reprove I would get from him if I ever told him how much I enjoyed his writing, you know, like, because I had read all of his works, and at the end of all of his works, I'd finished, well, the last book I'd read at the end of the line was his book, The Great Divorce, and that's his journey to heaven, as many people know. Like, and so he writes about the divorce of heaven and hell, whereas someone had written previously about the marriage of heaven and hell. And he goes to heaven and he meets his mentor, you know, he meets the guy that he gushed over, you know, he meets George MacDonald of all people, you know. And it's like, and the first thing George MacDonald says is, your love is misplaced in me, lad, you know. And it's like, oh my gosh, like, I imagine that the conversation would be similar, you know, like between me and C.S. Lewis. I admittedly have tempered my fanaticism over his writing over time, but like whenever I was first introduced to his books, I was like, oh my gosh, how could, like, you know, how does a guy like this exist? You know, like, so brilliant. And then like, now I feel that way just about everybody whose book I read, for the most part, unless it's a modern book, because a lot of modern books are written, like, for instance, I've read several, Billboard Top 100, essentially of books, though. I don't know, New York Times bestsellers. That's the equivalent in my mind anyways. But like, and they're like, so they're almost written to sell you something for whatever reason. Like, they're just written in like ad copy. And like, it's something that I hate, you know. But like, to your point that there are someone out there that likes the long form, like, I know at least I could, you know, I like that, you know, I like reading something like that. Not all the time, of course, but like, I am among that audience of people who likes long form. But then, like, there, like you had mentioned, you know, there's always that pressure to constrain yourself so that you'll be listened to, you know, like for the soundbite era, you know. And like, I feel like that's the tear, in a sense, you know. Like, if you have an important message, it's like, how can I get it to the people who I want to listen to it, you know. Like, for instance, this podcast, like, it's a long form thing, and like, very few, like, not many people will listen to something that's an hour long, you know. But the people that I want to reach with it are the people that, like, the message is essentially like for people, you know, who are in their, you know, 20 to 30s, who essentially feel like lost in the world, you know. Like, and like, I imagined, like, you know, they ask you to come up with you're a perfect audience or whatever. And it's like, I had thought of basically like a 27-year-old nihilistic dishwasher, you know, like, who hates the world and hates himself because of what he is in the world, you know. And like, giving, you know, bringing on, you know, interesting people who've done very difficult things, even very difficult things without promise of reward, to kind of ignite that call to meaning, essentially, you know. And so it's like, but the message in some ways, like, will be lost to a great number of those people, because, you know, who's going to listen to this for an hour, you know. But I don't know, sometimes, like, I can't remember if you said this or if I heard this somewhere else, because the conversations are blurring together for me, but essentially it all requires persistence, like your work. Oh yes, the the idea that it takes 12 years or 10 years for something to get going, and Pixar Toy Story began 12 years in, you know, it's like, and then their message was heard and now it's a household name, you know? So, yeah. Are there any things that you do in particular to fight off that threat of like conforming to making a, like a soundbite message, I guess?
I think I probably make soundbite messages too often. I think reading really does it a lot. Reading things like C.S. Lewis makes me want to not do what the modern books do, even mm-hmm. though they're going to be the popular thing right now. It makes me want to shoot for something timeless as opposed to immediate and then it's gone. You know, we have books right now that if you said the name of, everybody's going to know, and they'll be like, oh yeah, I read that, or whatever the case might be. In 50 years, nobody's going to have heard of those books. Yeah. And if you bring up The Great Divorce, they're going to still be reading it 100 years from now because it's amazing. And to anyone listening who has not read it, you need to go read that book right now. It is literally my favorite book of all time. It is the only book that I've ever read that when I got to the last page, I turned to the first page because I wanted to read it again. Mm-hmm. It was crazy how good it was. And when you were speaking, one of the things that popped into my head was that C.S. Lewis would agree with you because his quote is that there can be no book long enough to suit me. And I think there was something about tea in there mm-hmm. too. But it's so amazing that in spite of that, he didn't write that way. He didn't publish that way. And when I finished The Great Divorce, I was genuinely devastated that there was no more Great Divorce to read. Mm-hmm. And I wished it went on for 1,000 more pages. But he knew that, you know, this is just an allegory for something that you're going to eventually see. I'm not going to let you live in it. We're done. You need to move on. You need to get back to life, because otherwise all of us are going to just be sitting here reminiscing about what's going to happen. And it's just not what we're here for. So to stave off specifically the allure of writing for marketing purposes, I guess, the two things that I would say are, firstly, don't, to the best of your ability, do not care about things like follower counts. Do not care about things like public, you know, fanfare. I understand how hard that is, especially in our world today where that's like the number one thing. One of the best things that I ever did in my life, which is a weird little thing, but it really matters, is I stopped looking at how many Twitter followers I have. Like, I just don't care anymore. The people who are going to read what I write are the people I'm talking to. And if it's 10 people, or if it's 1,000 people, or if it's 500,000 people, I just don't care. Because if my message is the truth, then it doesn't matter how many people I'm talking to. And we get so caught up in the publicity of it all and the numbers of it all. And I understand the allure, and I understand how sometimes that can be beneficial financially. We were talking a little bit earlier about how Weekend Panda does not make money. It's just not financially feasible. We keep doing it in the hopes of turning it into something that's sustainable. But right now, it's just not. If we had quit a year ago because the first couple games did not succeed, then we'd be screwed. But our goal is something bigger than that. Our goal is to build something that lasts, that eventually, hopefully, pays some bills. But I think that bigger picture mindset can really help. So I said two things, and I think that was one thing. Just long. So yeah, definitely I would say don't care about the follower end of things. And if I think of the second thing that I had before I started talking, I will let you know, but now it's has disappeared from my mind. Yeah, I guess it would be, you know, to not pay attention as much to that stuff, to write the truth as best you can, or, you know, produce whatever it is that you're doing. Mm-hmm. But if I feel like if you chase the numbers, you're just going to always be chasing numbers. That number's never going to get high enough that you're going to be happy. When you hit 1 million, you're going to want 2 million. Like, it's just how it works. I'm a big fan of the idea of small community. I attend a very small church. They're great people. I know everybody by name. When somebody brings up a prayer concern, I legitimately care. Where I don't think you get that. Like, they don't even do like prayer concerns in a mega church. And for some people, a mega church may be the thing for them, and that's fine. But I see the benefit of a small group. Same thing with cities. I live in Pittsburgh, which is a city. It is also one of the smallest cities. You know, you consider it a city. I like visiting New York City, but I can't imagine living in an environment like that because it's just so enormous that how could you ever, it just boggles my mind. So I see the benefit of small towns where people know each other. And if you take that and you translate it to your work, you can have a little community with your work. That's cool. Do it. Don't be like, this community sucks because it's 20 people instead of 25 people, I guess is what I would say. And I think that that really helps to stem off some of that dread of, I need to produce for a mass audience. And maybe that's, you know, what you're called to do is to produce for a mass audience. That's fine. But for people like you and I, and maybe some people who like the dishwasher, who's just not finding that mass audience, don't discount the two people online who are so excited that you just released a book or you just released a new blog post or whatever it is. Like, they're chomping at the bit for that thing. And you now have the ability, thanks to the internet, to have one of those people be in the United Kingdom and one of those people be in India, and you're in wherever. And that's super cool. So I say celebrate that, and let it be enough.
Oh man, that was really good. Let me think here for a second.
While you're thinking, I want to tell one C.S. Lewis story because it kind of ties into it, and I could talk about C.S. Lewis for the rest
absolutely
of my life.
Absolutely. Yeah, same.
You were talking about how C.S. Lewis is so good at pointing out visuals, and there's one passage among many that stuck out to me. I think it was in his book, Surprised by Joy. He was talking about learning, I think, Greek. It might have been Latin, but I'm thinking it's Greek. And he said, when you really know a language, the word ship in that language will instantly conjure up into your head a picture of a ship. You won't think of the word ship and then translate it into your natural tongue and then think of the ship. And like he said, that was the thing that made all the difference for him, because he knew he had made it when he read that word in another language and a ship appeared in his mind. And I thought that that was such a cool thing, because it's like, oh, I could totally get that because of the visual aspect. And then tying into that, one of the other interesting things that came from that, and I don't know if this was part of his point, but it's what came to me, is that when I see the word ship, it is a vastly different ship in my head than what C.S. Lewis thought of when he saw the word ship, just because of the time difference from when we've been alive, just because of our location difference. And that really was a clarifying moment for me language-wise, because what I realized was I can pick the best words that I can possibly pick, but what I know of as love is vastly different from what anybody else is going to think of, what they're going to tie that word to. So no matter how good of a linguist I am always going to fail in some sense, because I'm not going to be able to convey exactly what I'm thinking. I have to trust that the other person's going to fill in gaps. So I really like that part of C.S. Lewis, that he talked about the ship and how it never occurred to me language-wise. Oh, yeah. I tried to learn Chinese. It does not go well every time I attempt it, but I'm working on it. And it's that sort of thing. If I see a motorcycle, I can say motochu, and it's the thing. It's not a translation of the word motorcycle to me. But there are other words that I sit there and I'm like, okay, that means that, that means that. Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, I get your point now. So it's a really neat thing about language, that whole, the words just represent stuff, and the words are beautiful but meaningless in a way, mm-hmm. because they mean the thing they mean, not the thing they are. I mean, it's a fascinating thing. I really enjoy just thinking about.
Do you find that like your ability as an artist like allows you to like to kind of be more descriptive in your language and like to be more accurate whenever you're like you're going to describe something? Like, are the things you like, I don't know how much you speak in like figurative language, like, or how much you use like metaphor, analogy, etc. Like, but do you think that like your artistry kind of like allows you, like if you're going to describe a ship, for instance, like of course you can say ship, but like maybe you mean a specific type of ship. Like, does it give you more of a, I say like a, like just, are your words more precise because like you're used to be drawing detailed images?
I think that the benefit to the art is that I can see it all in my head. And that's something that came so naturally to me over my life that I didn't realize it wasn't the case for other people. Interestingly, the time that it occurred was when I got to an age where people I knew were buying houses. My wife and I have fixed up houses that we've lived in. Each house that we bought has been kind of a disaster area. And then we've bought it and fixed it so that it's, you know, pretty. I don't go all the way to gorgeous because there's still holes in the ceiling from 5 years ago, but I ignore those holes now. So when we were with people, friends, even family members who were buying houses, we'd go see a place and they'd be like, this is hideous. I don't want this house. And we would say, just look at its potential. Like, you just visualize this wall not there, and then, you know, a big counter here and this and that. And they just, I mean, it wasn't a thing for them that they just looked at it and said, you know, it is what it is. So I think in a sense, my art side helps the writing side, because I can just sit there. I don't even necessarily have to close my eyes, and I can see the ship in one of the stories that I've been working on forever. I get to see it. I can walk around it if I want to. So that helps. I'm not sure if it directly translates into the actual language, because that's the part I struggle with more. I am terrible at analogy. I love analogy. I love allegory, but I am awful at it. And so I'm just now learning how to be better at it. And mostly because of C.S. Lewis and how good he is. I've been practicing and trying to improve it. And if I could throw in one more suggestion for somebody who's in maybe a similar position, even that nihilist dishwasher, you have to practice and fail at it. Like, you really do. It's going to suck for a while, but you'll get better at it. But you have to practice and fail at it. William Lane Craig, I believe it is, has a book where he talks at one point about how important it is for somebody who wants to do apologetics to go into debates and then fail really hard. But he talks about it, I'm pretty sure that I'm getting this right, and if not, forgive me, about planting seeds. And you're not there to just grow a forest, you're there to just plant some seeds, and then you move on and you learn from it and they learn from it, hopefully, and everybody just learns and continues on forward. And I think there's a real, there's something there really important, because in our world today, like with art and with writing and with any creative work, probably non-creative work too, we see the best of the best constantly. You go on Instagram and you look at art, and it's freaking amazing. And it's done by people half your age, if you're my age, and you hate them. But you don't really hate them. You're envious. They're so good. You can't quit because of that. And I see so many people quit because of that. It's, if you quit because of that, you're doomed. You're never going to get anywhere, because there's always going to be somebody better than you. But if you try and you fail, eventually you're going to produce something that somebody really likes, and that's totally worth all of the failures. I think I went so far off of what you asked
I think you got into some good ground. You can kind of find the same sentiment in Lewis as well, where he says, he said something to the effect of like, it's not my successes it's not my failures that caused me to doubt myself, rather it's my success, you know? And he was talking about, in particular, defending Christianity. He said, you know, I never doubt the thing of which, I've never doubt anything unless I've so successfully defended it to a group of people, you know, like it's not. And so like that idea of like, I don't think in like what you're saying, like failure shouldn't produce the doubt, you know, like, but of course neither really should success, but in some senses, like, of course it will, because you'll always be like wondering like, why was that, you know, I don't understand why that worked so well, or why, you know, that got so much attention, or why, you know, like you find like that you'll be examining that till you die, basically, you know, like there, you know, the multiplicity of variables in life make it impossible for complete and total analysis and reflection on any event that happens, you know? So it's like, it's one of those things that's like, you could never figure out why you succeeded or why you failed. And sometimes it's arbitrary, and sometimes it's yourself, you know. Of course you shouldn't like forego self-reflection. Like maybe you're failing because you're just not good at this thing, you know, like I was talking last night about calling, meaning, and purpose. Like people often like think that they feel their calling or feel their purpose. And like, I kind of find that to be in some senses the opposite of what I hold to be true. I think that to find your purpose in life or your meaning, it's the actualization of pre-existing skills and talents, you know? So like, are things that you have a proclivity for, you know, like things that you have an affinity for, you know, like there are things like, and your goal is to actualize as many of those at once as possible, you know? And so like, that would be like your specific calling. But then I also like kind of brought up the idea of like a meta calling, a calling in which all other callings are built. And that's the calling to the transcendent good or God, you know, like, and so that's the imitation of good and virtue incarnate, you know, and so like, or the imitation of Christ, you know. And so like on that meta calling, that is like, that's being kind, virtuous, good, etc. That's the meta calling. You can live up to that calling at any place, no matter what you're doing, whether it's professional or otherwise. But then there's the individual callings, which are like, whether I should be an artist or a writer or, you know, a mechanic or a taxi car driver, etc., you know, like, and I'd say like looking for your calling or looking for your purpose, like maybe it's not the thing that you're always successful at or the thing that you're maybe even the thing that you're always failing at. Like it could be either of those things, because you could have skill in those areas and still succeed, still fail, or still, you know, like very often the success doesn't always come as a direct byproduct of the skill or the talent of the individual, you know? And so it's like you just kind of like, if you, like, for instance, like if you're a good drawer, if you have a head for writing, if you know how to use a computer, if you are, if you understand marketing, if you have a good work ethic, if you have good people skills, like, you can actualize, you know, maybe five of those by being a freelance artist, or maybe you actualize all six, you know, and like, that's, I would say that would be living, you know, finding your calling or pursuing your calling or purpose, you know? And like, I think you're exactly right. A lot of people focus on, the failures and they just get upset and they're like, oh, you know, I can't do this. Like I suck. Look at how good, you know, Susie Glue is. And she's 16, you know, like, I find myself getting in that vein because like I read a lot of like books by Nobel Prize winners. I just finished a book by Richard Feynman, who was a Nobel Prize winning physicist. And it's just absurd because he was teaching at Princeton or MIT when he was my age, you know, like, and I'm 25, you know, and it's like, oh my gosh, you know, like it's just insane to me to think that that's happened, you know, that I read all these other books and like, you know, they Soren Kierkegaard was publishing books when he was my age and all sorts of stuff like that. And I'm like, how, like it seems impossible. Isaac Newton discovered gravity when he was 24, you know, like it's like one of those things that's just very upsetting to me. But like, you're exactly right. And I think, what is it called? Like the globalization, or like you used to only be able to compare yourself to those people who were in your neighborhood, you know, like, so you could be the best quarterback, but you'd be the best quarterback out of like 30 kids on the street in Pittsburgh, you know? And now you think you're the best quarterback and you're 14 and you get on Instagram and you can see a 12-year-old prodigy throwing spirals through a 50-yard hoop or something. It's like, that's absurd, you know? Like the bar for competition is increasingly getting higher and higher. Are you ever like worried are you ever worried about this kind of like spiral of competition, like this sort of like globalization of success or something like that? Like, are you ever worried about like the effects that might have on the future generations? Or I don't know if you have kids, but like, are you worried about how that's going to affect the world?
Yeah. So, The worry is always there, I think, regardless of what's going on in the world. And I've come to understand that that is a thing that human beings are very good at. We are good at fearing the unknown. We are good at fearing the future. We are good at taking a thing and then just expanding it outward in either direction until we are so afraid of everything that we're just on Twitter screaming all the time. So yes, I would naturally say that I am worried about all that stuff happening. Also, in simultaneous parallel to that, I am increasingly less worried about the future because I know God, and I know that he's going to finish this out in a way that's going to work in spite of all the messes that we make. So my heart breaks for the kids who are going to be coming up soon, who are going to be, I mean, like the leading desire now for kids is to be a YouTube star. Yeah. That's what they aspire to. I said I worked in a high school an elementary school cafeteria. It was eye-opening to talk to a lot of those kids who are now not wanting to be astronauts and police officers or whatever. They want to be YouTube stars. And that life sucks. I think that everybody who watches the life of a YouTube star will quickly understand that it is hard and it is sometimes lonely and it is not everything that it looks like. So emotionally, I am really sad for the people who are going to try to chase after those numbers and fail, or even the ones that succeed. But also, I think really good things can come of it if they survive the journey, because they can get insights to a place where they wake up one day and say, I'm worthwhile just as me. I don't need these numbers. I don't need this attention like I once maybe did. And I think that they're, in a sense, when they get there, which hopefully they do, they're going to be stronger than our generation or the people, you know, before us, because they're going to come to this understanding of what's really important. It's almost like a Solomon thing, you know. Ecclesiastes, Solomon laments because he tries all this stuff. And he eventually comes to vanity of vanities. Everything is vanity. Like, all of this stuff that I tried is garbage. Listen to me. Don't chase after it. But he couldn't have done that if he didn't try it all. So I think that a lot of kids are going to see those comparisons, and they're going to feel awful that there are people who are way better than them. But if they can get over that, they're going to be better off. They're going to be better off than if they had never encountered that resistance. If they had never seen the 12-year-old football prodigy, they're going to be driven to be better. I'm a big fan of tennis. The U.S. Open is going on right now, and the collective players that are a part of the group right now, and it's slowly changing because they're about ready to retire. Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, all these folks, they pushed each other because there was somebody way better than them. There's no Federer as we know him without Nadal, and there's no Nadal as we know him without Federer. So I think that in a sense, as long as they use it to drive them, it's going to get really cool. You're going to see some amazing stuff because of that competition. At the same time, there's going to be a lot of devastation. If the internet existed when I was making Fred the Monkey comics, I don't think I'm where I am today, because they were not good enough. They were great for my little middle school bubble. They were not great compared to all the amazing things that I watch people do right now. I would have just been floored by everybody else and then just consumed. I think a lot of great works are not going to get done because we are consuming so many of other people's great works. There's just so much good stuff out there right now. So,
Go ahead.
I was going to say, just to finish up, I am a natural worrier. So my goal right now in this point in my life is to stop that. So to answer your question directly, I am worried, and also I'm doing everything I can to not be.
Mm-hmm. I think it kind of goes back to something you had previously said too about local communities or small communities, mm-hmm. like developing this, like, you know, 10 people following 10 true fans on Instagram, or, you know, maybe it's just, you know, your family reads it and you are your church family and it's a small church, you know, that kind of thing. Like, I think that, like, that would be better too. Like, cause I think what you were saying about the tennis players, like, you do need that. You do need someone better than you to push you up and on, you know? But I think in some senses, like, it should be someone in your community, you know, someone that you can really spar with, you know. Like, I think about this story, and it was something my logic professor told me, but now I can't really, I've been searching for this. And so if anyone can find this, or if you know, whenever I start telling you the story, like, where I can find it, because he said, and I may be remembering it, and maybe he said the name of the person wrong, but it was written by Augustine, St. Augustine. And it was something about the, like, was it either an essay on the academy, but I can't find any reference to this, but I'll start telling the story anyways. He says, essentially, the perfect life for the philosopher is not one where he solidifies himself into an ivory tower with his books and is content to be alone by himself, furthering his intellect, but rather it's where he lives in a house, and it's a house teeming with all sorts of people from different backgrounds, intelligences and things like that. But so whenever he lives in this house, it's also important for him to have a partner, a sparring partner, someone who is in the same field as him, but just barely better than him, so that whenever they engage in conversation or debate, he's always losing, but just barely, just so that he can almost feel that he might win. And then also, along with the person who's better than him in his trade, there should also be he also has the other people of the house. He also has the maids, the garden workers, the attendants, like, you know, his spouse, maybe his children. And so he has this hierarchy, or this gradient, where not only does he have to be able to reach the highest of heights whenever he's arguing with his partner, because he's always reaching higher because he's always losing, and to try and grasp this win. It's also important that he doesn't know that he's destined to lose, but so he's always climbing the heights of his intellect, but he's also having to go as low as the lowest of lows. He's always having to talk with the gardeners in a way that makes sense to the gardeners. He's always having to talk with he's always having to talk with the maids. He's always having to talk with the, you know, the cooks, his wife, like, his children, like, all these people will have different aptitudes and different, like, professions. They'll have a different, I can't think of the word, but they'll be specified in different areas. Yeah. And it's essentially, it's the most important thing to have this variance of community, but also, like, when he was thinking about this, if it was Augustine or maybe it was someone else, I don't know. Whoever was thinking of this, he wasn't thinking of, like, competing with, I know the only tennis player I know is Serena Williams. So, and I'm really bad at tennis, and I've played tennis with my wife, but I'm trying to imagine, like, there's probably, like, Serena Williams is obviously at the top. Like, that's why I know about her, I guess. And so, but there's probably like people who are just all barely below Serena Williams, like everyone who competes with Serena Williams, right? And like to think that like I somehow have to be better than them before I can even start playing tennis is it's like something that is like a non-starter for so many people. And whenever you say that we'll lose many great works to that fear of comparison, I agree with you. Whenever you think of like a solution to this, I sometimes wonder if, and I'd be interested to see if you agree or what you think about this idea, but like if social media wasn't a global thing, but rather a local thing. So like you didn't like, whenever you got Facebook friends, like maybe there's a place for getting them like from around the world. Like maybe that, like we already have Facebook for that. But if there was like a local, like where you only talk to the people in your street, neighborhood, et cetera, like people participated in this, like there's no like traditional community anymore, you know, like there's no village. So like that kind of like local companionship, competition, et cetera, I think is lost, you know? And so like, I'd be interested to see like, one, do you think a platform where it's specified and worked on that area would even work? And two, like if it didn't work, how do you think we could return the traditional village to modern day?
Those are really good questions. I will give initial answers and then I will think deeper about them because they are deeply complex and I don't know that any answer that I come up with would be good enough. I love the idea of a social media that's close. There is a platform called, I think, My Next Door or Next Door. I think it's just called Next Door, which interestingly my mother is part of. Even that seems too big in a sense, because the people who are on there, they start to know each other a little bit, and that's good, but it's such still a big community. So I'm not sure if it's even possible. What I would say is that maybe there's a place for that, and there's also a place for just small communities of people, even if they're not close. The things I think of, there's one internet forum that's still running that I have been part of for many, many years, and we all know each other, and it doesn't really get new people very often, but it's a small collection of folks, and we have vastly different opinions, and I argue more there, I swear, sometimes than other places, but we have that community. Even though it's online, that on Twitter, I am part of a direct message group that, it's just a small community, and it's some Christians from all over the world. And we are there to support each other in a way that you don't get on Twitter proper. And it's a beautiful thing. And I think some of the people there in that group have kind of turned Twitter into just that group, and they don't even really bother all that much with regular Twitter anymore. So that sense of smallness and connection really is neat. And I think that it can happen online, but I don't know that it can be non-organic. I don't know if it's doable to create a platform that would force people to do that. Because I think based on where we are now, and what we have, to force it would be for somebody's feelings to take away a freedom, a sense of, now obviously if it's an on purpose platform, you enter into it willingly, but I think there's some part of a person that would say, why am I limiting myself? Instead of seeing it as the opposite of limiting, which I think it would be, expanding you, I think they would see it as a limiting. In that same sense, I'm not sure what will ever get us back to small town, small village, individual groups. I don't know. I am generally pretty good at creative thinking and coming up with ideas. That one really stumps me. Apart from something massively tragic or horrific, like civilization ending, I don't know what could possibly convince us that that was the thing to do. Maybe several generations from us, they're going to be so integrated with the online world that they'll start to almost wake up and say, this isn't great. Something could be far better than this. What if we try something different? But I think it's going to have to be different. Whereas you and I and people who are, you know, aged above us, it's hard for me because at 25, you probably still always had the internet.
I started using the internet when I was 4 years old.
Yeah. So this is part of your world. And so to go back is, it's not different enough, I guess I would say yet. Like, it's not a jump. It's not a leap to a different place. It's just, this feels like a continuation of what we've progressed to currently. There will come a day when this will just be what always was. And so going back at that point, man, looking at myself, I use a lot of air quotes. Going back to what was still feels like going back. And I think there will come a day when going back to what was will feel like it's going forward, if that makes sense.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Oh, whoa. That was really good what you just said there. It kind of tied it all together for me. Have you ever heard of G.K. Chesterton? He's, you know, journalist. He influenced C.S. Lewis a lot. He wrote prolifically, hundreds and hundreds of books, like just insane. And he's a genius too. And he wrote in his book Orthodoxy, which is like one of his seminal works, he talks about a man who set sail from England to go and discover Africa, only to find that he's sailed around back to England. And so he plants a flag where Wales is and calls it New Wales, and he goes to, you know, London and raises a tower and calls it, you know, New London, and like all of a sudden only to realize in a shock of horror and satisfaction that he's traveled right back to home. Essentially, you get all the thrills of going abroad and all the safety and comfort of remaining at home. And he expounds on this issue. He says he wasn't going to write a book about this, but he puts it in one of his books, one of my favorite books by him, Man Alive. And he tells a story about a guy who his name was Innocent Smith, and that's what he was, innocent. So he does things odd. For instance, he buys expensive gifts, not for the items in them, but for the tinsel paper they're wrapped in because it's good for drawing. And he eats in places where no one eats. So he goes onto the roof of a house that no one lives in to eat his lunch, or different things like that. And one of the most And basically he goes on several adventures, the adventures of Innocent Smith. And one of them is, he never enters his house the normal way, never goes to the front door. He's always trying to gain a new perspective. So he's always breaking into his house through different ways, through either the windows, the chimney, etc. And finally, one day he says he's going through the back door, but he goes all the way around the world to enter the back door of his house. So along the way, he discovers, he goes to Russia, to China, and then like to this island where there's a sage. And all the while he says, I'm looking for a red house. Have you seen the house on the hill, the house where all men grow to love, and like all these things, you know, and like he tells poems all along the way, and come to find out he was just talking, like, you don't know he's talking about his house, but at the end you find out he was just going to his house through the back door, you know, the long trip home, as C.S. Lewis would call it. Yeah. You know? And so like, I like that idea of going so far that we come back around. I think that is the most probable way that we'll return to sort of like communal living or the village again, you know?
I would agree. And that's a great story. I have to put that one on my reading list because I haven't read a ton of Chesterton, but man, his quotes are incredible.
He's
a good guy. It's stuff I wish I could do, but hey, you know, everybody's got there. I'm sure he had a writer like C.S. Lewis did that he was like, oh, never be as good as that guy.
Yeah, pretty much everybody. But And so, like, if you're going to get into them, I definitely recommend, like, not Man Alive is a fiction, and it's like, seriously, I mean, I've read it seven times in like the same month that I finished it. Like, it is so profound and affected me so deeply. And it's essentially like, it's a meditation on the holy fool, essentially. You know, like, if you've ever read The Praise of Folly by Erasmus, or The Idiot by Dostoevsky, like, those books are also in like with Man Alive. But Man Alive, though it was written like 150 years ago, it's like very modern, you know, like the way it's written. Like, so anybody could get in and read that book and like enjoy it. And I actually recommend the Audible version, which is the one that I listen to, because it's dramatized. So there are different voices for all the characters, and it's like very, very interesting. It's more like a radio show than anything else. Cool. But yeah, very, 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 very highly recommended. It will make you, made me see, you know, greener grass and a brighter sun by finishing it, you know.
Good deal.
I feel like we've touched on just about every topic under the sun. And I think we're about at an hour now, or maybe just over. I guess we could call it here, and we could continue the discussion into a future episode or something like that.
I would be more than happy to join you again. This was super cool.
Awesome. So, I guess just let people know where they can find your new book, your art, your video games, etc.
I am spread out all over the place. I guess I would point you to weekendpanda.com first and foremost, since that is my wife and I project, and the one that I really hope succeeds. But I'm also at jkreiki.com. That's where the new book, Responding to Russell, is located, if you're at all interested in a response to Bertrand Russell's essay, Why I Am Not a Christian. I had a ton of fun writing a response to that. I tried to be as charitable as possible. I tried to just care about him. I know that he is not a fan of religion, and I understand that. I think the thing that he was most unhappy with are the hypocrites like me who don't live out their faith. Every day I try and work on that. So I understand his position. Anyway, those are some places that you can find me. Otherwise, send me a note on Twitter, and I'm on there far too often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, aren't we all? All right, well, thank you so much for coming on, and we'll see you in the next one.
Thanks.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode of the Will Work for Purpose podcast. If you liked what you heard here, you can find the podcast wherever major podcasts are found, as well as YouTube. So you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, YouTube, Stitcher, etc. Wherever you listen to your podcast, you can find this podcast. If you want to support the work that I'm doing, subscribing is a good way to help, or you can check out the merch store, and the link for that will be in the description below, and you can buy this sweatshirt that I've been wearing, which is the anti-nihilism, or the anti-meaninglessness sweatshirt. So thanks for watching. Leave your impressions of the show in the comments below, or wherever you happen to be listening to this. And if you want to be on the podcast yourself, or want me to interview someone, you can contact me at mosley@tweakingo.com. And you can find the rest of my work at tweakingo.com. Again, thanks for listening, and I'll see you in the next one.